You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And the country of India, taking a stand against a giant pharmaceutical company, against, as they say it in Germany, Bayer, or here, Bayer, and a decision that could have far-reaching effects around the planet. The Indian government is saying, you know, charging $50 a pill for a medicine to treat cancer that costs well under $0.50 a pill to make is just not right. And we are going to authorize an Indian company to manufacture it and all the and sell it for $1 a pill, which will be profitable for them. And out of all those sales, 6% of the revenue is going to go to Bayer to compensate them for their cost and their patent. India is taking on the patent laws, these international patent laws. I find this absolutely fascinating, and particularly having read Thomas Jefferson. Thomas, you go back, and I strongly encourage you to read the correspondences in 1787 between Jefferson and Madison, when James Madison was helping write the Constitution, and Jefferson was living in Paris as the U.S. envoy to Paris, basically our diplomat there, our ambassador. And Jefferson wrote these letters back saying, that he was going to get the Virginia delegation to refuse to ratify the Constitution if a Bill of Rights wasn't attached to it. And there was a bunch of things he wanted in that Bill of Rights, and all of them got in, with the exception of two. One was that he wanted an absolute ban on standing armies during time of peace. There could be a Coast Guard and a Navy, but no standing armies. And the second was he wanted no monopolies in commerce. In other words, no patent laws, no copyright laws. Jefferson never copyrighted anything. He invented hundreds of things. He never patented any of them. Neither did Ben Franklin. Neither did, frankly, to the best of my knowledge, any of the founders, although there were patent laws available under British law at the time to them. They just didn't do it. So, and he didn't think that Americans should, because he made the point over and over again that anybody who invents stands on the shoulders of all the people before him or her who invented all the previous things that this is just a tweak to, because there is nothing new. John Manwelian is on the line with us. He's an attorney and concerned about this issue. He's with the Manwelian. John, am I pronouncing that right?
You're pronouncing it perfectly, Tom.
Okay,
Manwelian
thanks.
Law Firm.
Yeah, ManwelianLawFirm.com is the website, Manwelian LawFirm.com. John, We're up to 17 and a half years for pharmaceuticals, 20 years for most things, and our patent laws in the United States. We didn't have any patent laws until 1790, and it was 14 years then. Had the patent laws been rigorously enforced, arguably Thomas Edison couldn't have invented the light bulb, because he would have been infringing on patents of people who had figured out that you could illuminate, carbon by running electricity through it. That was a full decade earlier. Why do we have to have such long-term government regulations to provide, a revenue stream, arguably welfare, for big corporations?
Okay, well, first, let me take you back to the science and the invention process. You said something before that I don't completely agree with, that nothing is brand new. There are certain drugs that are breakthrough technology and sciences that come out every day. These large companies like Bristol-Myers...
And they happen out of nothing.
Sometimes. It depends on the area of science. Sometimes it's breakthrough, sometimes it's not.
So nobody had to figure out what was a molecule. Nobody had to figure out what was an atom. Nobody had to figure out how to use Petri dishes. Nobody had to figure out how to do animal experimentation or human experimentation.
Right. If you go with that argument, then you're basically saying that nothing could be patented, and that's problematic enough.
No, what I'm saying is the patents should be... Jefferson said 3 years maximum. I'm with him on it.
Well,
that's
okay,
enough time to recoup your investment, particularly with drugs. Half of all the drugs in the United States, the new, not by new drugs. I'm not talking about let's move one molecule on Prozac and turn it into new super Prozac. I'm talking about generating brand new categories of drugs, the macrolides, the penicillins, the cyclines, the tetracyclines, the quinolones. Each one of those, which were breakthroughs, these were major breakthroughs. All of those were developed with federal money through National Institute of Health grants to universities. And the universities handed that off to pharmaceutical companies, and then the pharmaceutical companies sliced and diced those drugs down to, okay, in the cycline range, we'll have doxycycline and tetracycline and whatever, I don't know all the names of it. And in the quinolone, we'll have, you know, Cipro, and we'll have Floroquine or whatever it is, Flox, but I do know that each one of these major breakthroughs was federally funded. Why are we giving the drug companies all this money?
Because it takes time, Tom. The bottom line is it takes a lot of money and a lot of time for these drugs to go through the certain phases before they actually become FDA approved. For example, most drugs take approximately $1 billion and 10 years of research and development to actually go through the patent and trade process. And less than 10% of these drugs don't actually ever make it. So it takes time. If there was a graph, it takes about a few years for you to make your money back on the research and development. It takes billions of dollars in costs.
You know, you're right, John. You're absolutely right. And the FDA process is 8 years to get, you know, from first application till final marketing is 8 years. And we broke that out yesterday on our show, point by point. So if it's 8 years, then let's make the patent for 8 years. Why 20 or why 17 and a half?
I believe because the Congress and the people to pass law happy medium, and they decided that it takes an amount of years for the company to make profits. Remember something, towards the latter end of the patent, not making as much profit. In fact, the profit drops down 90% once that patent is released. So the companies are going to be making any money towards the end of that patent. And it's sort of like an airplane going up. When you reach that peak of altitude, now the plane is going back down. There's only a small window of time that money is made in those pharmaceutical companies. And what I'm talking about is the R&D. It costs billions of dollars, Tom, to develop these products. And
right, and we're paying for most of it with our tax dollars.
I don't agree with that. I think these are profit corporations. These aren't not all of the companies are receiving federal grants or loans.
No, they're not. They take the information from the universities. More than well over half, in fact, I believe the number is well over 70% of all the quote R&D done by pharmaceutical companies in the United States is not to develop new classes of drugs. It's to modify existing drugs, to make them extended release versions, to move one molecule around so that it's sufficiently new that they can renew the patent and come out with a brand new one. You know, proton pump inhibitors is another great example. You've got, you know, there's a dozen of those out now, the Nexium kind of drugs. There's a dozen of them out now. They were originally developed with NIH money, and the pharmaceutical companies have spent, billions of dollars on R&D, but it's been not to develop new categories of drugs. It's been to tweak these drugs purely for the purpose of extending their patents. So now we have a government regulation, the patent law, which is causing corporations, big pharmaceutical companies, to behave in ways that don't generate brand new drugs for the American public, but instead keep the old drugs, just keep reviving them so they can make more money off them. I'd like to incentivize them to develop all brand new categories of drugs.
Well, when you say it, it's a fair argument, and I understand your point, but let's just assume, arguendo, that you're correct. By doing what you want to do and taking away the patents or limiting it, you're limiting the profit, and these companies will not have incentive to conduct any R&D and any breakthrough science that may or may
certainly they will if they're in business
out.
anybody who's in business if the way
I,
that you
I,
make
I
your money
I
is
would have spent, I would have spent billions of dollars if I was CEO of these companies and knowing that profits are going to taper off after 6 years.
Why then, John, are there why are there companies that do nothing but sell drugs that have aspirin has been out of patent for over 100 years? I'm not sure if it was ever in patent. Why does Bayer bother to make it?
Well, remember, all of these companies have pipelines of drugs that are coming out. That's just one of the things in the pipeline of Bayer. So,
sure. So
they're not necessarily reliant on that one product to bring them billions of dollars. They're relying on the new products that people don't currently have, that people want right now. It's a supply and demand issue. They give a product that we all want, and they patent it. And the incentive is, hey, listen, you get to keep your profits for X amount of years. It's a happy medium that, the patent years that is applicable. It's a happy medium. It's nothing. There's no science behind the patents. It's just that's something that Congress and the government has decided that the companies would be comfortable with.
Otherwise, I got it. John, we're out of time. But you made your point very well. John Manoelian, ManoelianLawFirm.com, the website. Thanks, John.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is a topic I think we need to have a national conversation about. I doubt it'll happen because there's a lot of money from the pharmaceutical companies going into Congress right now. But I think we should talk about it.
This pill will set your mind at ease. It's called Progenitorovox. It's made by Squab Merle Co. It's a life-enhancing miracle, but there are some things you should know.
It may cause agitation, palpitations, excessive salivation, constipation, male lactation, rust-colored urination, hallucinations, bad vibrations, mild electric shock sensations, but it's worth it for the drugs I need.
There you go. Welcome back to Talk Media for the rest of us. I just find this amazing. I find it fascinating, you know, that the founders of this country refused to patent or copyright anything. That John Hancock, the richest guy to sign the Declaration of Independence, left behind nothing. None of them did. There are no family fortunes. There's no Carnegies or Rockefellers or Mellons or, you know, those kinds of fortunes. You have, you know, there's an insurance company named after John Hancock, but they basically just took his name. It wasn't like, hey, where's Hancock's relatives? Let's give him some money. No. These guys, they were genuine idealists in many regards. I mean, they were a little kinky in some regards, too. But they were, you know, with regard to a lot of these things, they were genuine idealists. And they were saying, you know, Jefferson arguing strongly to James Madison, make no patent or copyright laws. Let America be the land of innovation and invention, because patent laws are government welfare that prevent innovation. I mean, think of all the people who today would not be starting Apple in their garage, because today there are entire companies whose entire business model is to look for people who might have stepped on somebody else's patent or copyright and sue them on behalf of that company or harass them. By the way, very BFD story. The ISPs of the United States, or at least the major ones, according to a story over at rawstory.com, you can check it out, on July 12th, are planning to start spying aggressively on everything you're downloading from the Internet. And if any of it is copyrighted, which means they have to be basically reading every single word you're, you know, of everything you're bringing down and look at every single picture you're bringing down onto your computer off the Internet. If you are downloading anything that is copyrighted, they are going to threaten you, make you click through all kinds of things saying, yes, I understand that there are penalties for this, nail you if you repeat offend, cut your bandwidth down. I mean, this is, you know, breaking big deal story. Copyright law has gone insane. And patent laws are not far behind them. By the way, in the next hour of the program, I want to get in some considerable depth to the issue of the Republican Party, so stick around for that. But I know there are a few people who want to talk about this right now. So Steve in Chicago. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I was wondering if you were aware that the battery technology that Stanley Ovchinsky developed for the EV1, the GM car featured in Who Killed the Electric Car?
Right.
Was sold by GM to Chevron, and they have done nothing with it except sue other car companies for trying to use it.
Really? No, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
So what? Do you know anything about the technology?
No, I don't. I'm not an engineer. But the guy's name was Stanley Ovchinsky, and he was funded with federal dollars. And I think it's a great case for class action, but I don't know of any class action law firms that would be willing to take up such a daunting task and go up against Chevron.
Sure, and it's another great example of the abuse of our patent laws and how patent laws have become government welfare programs, and I don't get it why all these Republicans who are squealing about government regulations don't do something about this government regulation. Here's a government regulation I would love to see cut in half, patent laws. And copyright laws, for that matter. I mean, the books that I write are protected not only to my death, but for years and years after, largely because of the lobbying efforts of Disney. You know, keep the mouse alive forever. And I think, you know, at the very most, the words that I write should be copyrighted until I die. And frankly, if they're only copyrighted for 10 years, that's fine. Most books, you know, after, I can tell you as an author who's had books in print for more than a decade, you know, with very, very few exceptions. 10 years out, most of the books have been sold. You've made most of the money you're going to make. After that, it's just a trickle. And so, you know, put it in the public domain. I mean, or, you know, have the copyright laws roll out. I can't put my books in the public domain because I sell them to publishers and they then, you know, have the copyright. But, you know, this is a big issue. Steve, thanks a lot for the call. Chris in Seattle. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hey, how's it going, Tom? Listen to you for a long time. Got all your books. I'm a union painter. We all love you out here.
Great. Thank you.
Yeah, hey, I got a question, and I'm at odds with this, how to view this and feel about it. With the H.R. 347 that just passed and Obama signed a couple weeks ago.
This is the bill that establishes protected zones where you can't pick, where you can't protest.
Yeah, I call it the tape and censor bill.
Yeah.
But how do you see this? What do you feel about this? I'm confused. I don't know.
I'm confused too, Chris. This has come up in two or three of our production meetings where we've, you know, where we're putting together the topics of the day, and each time my response is the majority of Democrats supported this stuff, as well as Republicans.
I know. And so
I'm guessing that there actually is a national security dimension to it, because the way it was billed and the way it was sold was basically, you know, if the president shows up, the government should have the right to at least tape out an area, you know, to where somebody could shoot him from and make sure that anybody who goes into that area isn't carrying a weapon, that kind of thing. And
doesn't it feel like the Sedition Act resurrected again?
No, because the Sedition Act actually regulated what you say. And John Adams' Alien Sedition Acts and the Sedition Act of during the Woodrow Wilson administration, both of them said you could go to jail for what you say. This doesn't say you can go to jail for what you say. This says you can go to jail for standing in the wrong place and saying it. And there's a big difference.
Right. I mean, if law enforcement says, well, Chris, you're being disruptive, so here, let's
right.
go. Let's get in the
well,
here
you know,
go.
You it's like right now you can be disruptive on the street on Pennsylvania Avenue, but if you climb the fence and try to be disruptive on the lawn of the White House, you're going to get nailed. And
right.
I think what they're trying to say is if the president goes to Denver, then there's going to be a lawn of the White House there. But I've got to learn more about this myself, Chris. Thanks for raising the issue.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
27 minutes past the hour, and patents hold up commerce on the Internet? Jim thinks so. We'll get to him in just a second. Exposing the con and conservative, Tom Hartman here with you. I don't know if you saw the if you've seen the new MoveOn.org ad, but you know, if the Republican Party can kind of kiss the female vote goodbye, or at least large portions of it. But forget the female vote; the Latino vote is going against them. In a this is a new poll that just came out last night, and from Fox News of all places, President Obama beats Mitt Romney 70-14%, or any Republican, basically, with these more or less these same numbers, 70-14% among Latino voters. And these are people who are Hispanic ancestry, but actually U.S. citizens. I don't know why one would normally have to say that sort of thing, but in case there's any Fox News viewers, let me throw that qualification. Afghan President Hamid Karzai has said that the U.S. needs to pull out of all the rural areas of his country, which is probably 99% of the country. This is making our little war effort there, George Bush's war, very problematic. And Grover Norquist's head is exploding. Rick Crawford, the freshman Republican member of the House of Representatives, is saying, let's tax people on who make more than $2 million a year. Let's add a couple of points to their taxes. Nothing like rolling back the Reagan tax cuts. This isn't even going back to the Clinton tax levels that gave us a balanced budget, but it is going to cause a lot of sturm and drang in the Republican Party. So, anyhow, the copyright patent laws, things like this, I find this fascinating. I mentioned Jim in Camino Island, Washington, on the line, listening
hey,
to AM Talk 1090 in Seattle. Hey, Jim.
Hi. I don't know how many people know that the Internet commerce works because of a thing called RSA, public key cryptography, where two strangers can exchange a little bit of information and then set up a secure line for
right.
the.
This is how you get HTTPS.
Right.
Right.
And that was developed by three guys, Ron Rivest, somebody in Edelman or whatever,
mm-hmm.
Back, I think, in the very early 70s. And they patented it, and it had to wait on the shelf for that patent to expire, 17, 20 years, whatever it was, before we could use it. And it turns out in a situation like that, no matter how low the licensing cost,
we got the internet 20 years later, 17 years
exactly.
late, because these guys had patented the key piece that would make it. That's incredible. I did not know that. Jim, thank you for the adding to my ammunition here.
Yeah, a second for a happy anecdote. I was paying for my trees at my favorite nursery up the road here, Christensen's, and I said to the gal, thanks for advertising on AM 1090, and a cheer went up in the whole office there with the staff and
that's great.
And it was really fun.
So Christensen, tell me the name of the nursery.
Christensen's Nursery.
Christensen's Nursery in Seattle or suburb?
They're up in Mount Vernon.
In Mount Vernon. Okay. Here's a shout out to you guys at Christensen's, guys and gals, at Christensen's Nursery. Thanks so much for advertising on AM 1090 in Seattle. It is our advertisers, in particular our local advertisers and our local affiliates all across the nation that keep these stations going and keep them going well. When you hear an ad, in fact, when you hear an ad, if you're listening on commercial radio, of course, we're also on Pacifica, non-commercial stations, and although there are underwriters there, and on Free Speech TV, and we have underwriters. So, you know, if you hear somebody's name and you have a few spare minutes, give them a call and say, thanks for supporting the show, or thanks for supporting the station or the network or, you know, whatever it may be, because it means a lot. It really does.
It really felt good.
Yeah, okay. Jim, thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for the good spirit there that you did. Aram, am I saying that right, in Grapevine, Texas?
Yes, thanks. I called to talk about patent stuff, but while I was listening, you talked about Afghanistan. As an Iranian-American, I can make comments there, as well as Walter.
Sure. Aram, are you on a speakerphone? Can you please take it off speakerphone? You sound like you're standing in a manhole.
Is it any different?
That's a world of difference. Yes, sir. Thank you.
So I make it very quickly. On the patent stuff, there's a not-for-profit organization that works from San Francisco. They're called Electronic Frontier Foundation.
Right, EFF.
EFF.org. Patent, as well as internet privacy, is one of their, you know, issues.
Mm-hmm.
U.S., you know, we were like the haven for people in the early America that left Britain to come here, so they do away with patent and, you know, do inventions, and everybody was supportive of it. And
that's
nowadays
right.
We are basically going backward.
Yeah, patent law was one of the ways in the United Kingdom in the 1700s that the British East India Company and other large
right.
corporations locked down the ability to innovate.
Right. So the U.S. was a place that people could come and do away with those stringent laws and, you know, innovate. And I don't know why we have gone backward. On voter ID, I'm an election judge as well as election alternate judge in Tarrant County, which is
congratulations.
One of the biggest
good
counties in Texas.
Uh-huh.
So I can tell you on voter ID, it's completely bogus. It solves no issue. It only adds to rigmarole of getting people to come to vote. I've already sent my driver's license photo as well as the state issued ID photo. The photos are completely different. If somebody looks at me and looks at those two government-issued ID, he or she will, you know, say, I'm not the same person.
Mm-hmm.
So the photo ID solves nothing except adds to the burden of voting. And I can tell you,
because
I live in Texas, and I've been an election judge. We have never had an issue of somebody coming, and I've been an election judge, alternate election judge, since 2003
mm-hmm.
At various elections. So I can tell you firsthand. And I'm an Iranian-American, been here most of my life. The issue with Afghanistan could have been solved much better with the help of Iran, as Iran did help U.S.
Yep.
invade Afghanistan. They closed their borders. They captured fleeing Taliban.
Yep.
They helped, gave right of landing to the aircraft. They did emergency rescue missions. None of that made the news here. And then Bush came and, you know, named them axis of evil for something completely different.
Yeah.
Afghanistan can be still managed by help of Iran instead of going to Pakistan, who is the instigator of all of these issues.
Mm-hmm.
I hope everybody goes to EFF.org and sign up to support Electronic Frontier Foundation. And I thank you for giving me the airtime.
Thank you. Aram, let me just toss a quick metaphor past you. I have a friend who's a pharmacist. And it's been a couple of years since I've talked with him at length, but I remember a few years ago our having a conversation, and he's been a pharmacist for like 25, 30 years. He said, I have had a number of people come in and try and give me forged prescriptions for painkillers, for Vicodin or for Oxycontin or, you know, that stuff that Rush Limbaugh was on. But I have never, ever had somebody try to submit a forged prescription for an antibiotic, and which is also a prescription drug. Because, you know, if you're really sick, your doctor will give it to you, and it's not controversial. So if nobody's going to go to the trouble of forging a prescription for an antibiotic, you know, why would they go to the trouble of trying to pretend that there's somebody else in order to vote to be one vote out of 130 million votes or thereabouts? I mean, it just makes no sense. The reward-risk ratio is, I mean, I get it with somebody trying to get OxyContin that they can sell on the street or they can get high on. There, the risk is fairly high, but the reward is fairly high, at least in their mind. But
there is no issue with voter ID fraud in Texas.
Right. There's no reward for being a fraudulent voter. And so why take the risk? Nobody does.
Our problem is voter apathy. We just had a constitutional election last November in Texas. Only 4% of qualified, and I'm not telling you total registered voter, but 4% of qualified voters showed up.
Wow.
For a constitutional amendment.
Wow.
That's going to stay in Texas for as long as we are a state. There are idiots like Terry who think we should secede, but that guy, you know, dyes his color so much, I think his brain is cooked.
but that's
a different story. This thing going to stay with us for as long as we are a state. Only 4% of qualified voters showed up.
Amazing.
So our problem is voter apathy. Instead of making it easier, encouraging people to come and vote.
Yep, I got it. No, I have to move along, Aram.
That becomes...
I'm totally with you, and you said it so well. Thank you so much for calling, and thanks so much for listening to KTRC. Jeff, listening on AM 760 in Denver, you are in Winter Park, Colorado. Jeff, we got a minute to the break. What's on your mind?
Hey, Tom. I lost a house to eminent domain about 15 years ago, and my idea would be, what about eminent domain for intellectual property?
Oh, wow. That makes perfect sense.
Wasn't being used, use it or lose it.
Right. Go to whatever that oil company was. I think he said Chevron, that bought the patent for the battery for the electric car and now is sitting on it, and say, sorry, you don't own this anymore because the public good is served by our taking it under the Fifth Amendment, under the eminent domain provisions. And certainly, you know, Judge Souter and others on the Supreme Court have opened that door. You know, you know, right across the board, a whole variety of patents could probably be grabbed by eminent domain. That makes so much sense.
I mean, we should take some NASA scientists and just mine our own patent office and see if there is that 200-mile-per-gallon carburetor or the car that runs on water or all the,
the near-perpetual motion machine or the Tesla, the giant Tesla machine that will create electricity from the spinning, the current turning of the earth and the electric current therefrom, et cetera, et cetera. And if they're there, make them public. Jeff, I'm totally with you. Brilliant, brilliant. Thanks for listening to AM 760 in Denver. We'll be right back. It's 45 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Including Goldman Sachs. Guess how much their stock dropped yesterday when that article came out in the New York Times? I'll tell you after the break.
I was alone, I took a ride, I didn't know what I would find there. Another road where maybe I could see another kind of mind there. Ooh, and I suddenly see you.
Welcome back to the True People's Media. Tom Hartman here with you, and Eric in Chicago, listening to WCPT. Hey, Eric, what's up?
I want to start out by saying I'm not an attorney. Okay, so okay. I'm going to bring up
neither am I
the law here.
So we're on equal footing.
My point really is that I don't understand how the law can be misinterpreted, because in Article 1, Section 8, Subsection 8 of the Constitution. Okay.
It explicitly says that the Congress has the authority to make patent and copyright laws for the purpose of enhancing, the general welfare of the public good or something like that. You've got the language in front of you.
I can read it to you right now.
Okay, go for it.
If you'll indulge me.
Sure.
Okay, to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries.
Yeah.
Now, first of all, the limited times is important, but also the exclusive right, I think, should be pertinent.
Well, I think the most important part is the first five or six words, you know, to promote the, what was it again?
Well, to promote the progress of science and useful arts.
Right. And that's why we have patent and trademark laws. And you're not going to promote the progress of those things if you allow somebody to lock them down for 20 years.
Right. And, well, and the rest of it establishes limited times and exclusive rights.
That's
so,
correct.
I mean, corporations should not be able to purchase patents.
Well, that's
corporations should not be allowed to own patents.
It would be kind of cool if you could say only because, you know, frankly, I've known a number of people over the years, you know, friends who were engineers who worked for companies who participated in a team or who they themselves actually developed something that was patented and they got nothing for it. I mean, it was considered work for hire. They got their salary. The corporation owned what they invented and it owned the patent, and the patent in some cases made millions or hundreds of millions of dollars. And the corporation said to the employee, well, you got a job. And wouldn't it be cool if there was a law that said corporations cannot own patents and cannot own copyrights for that matter? They can merely get royalties from the owners themselves. And so if you work for AT&T or Bell Labs and you invent something really cool or you're part of a team that does, you as human beings all share in the patent or in the copyright. And if the company wants to market that product, they get to negotiate with you. And they could presumably negotiate with you in advance by way of contract on you know, for work. But you would have that ultimate stick to hit them over the head with, and so you could contract and say, you know, that's, you know, like movie stars do. That's fine. You want to make a movie star with, you want to make a movie with me in it? Give me 5% of the revenue.
Right. Yeah. But here's, I think that this also touches tangentially upon Citizens United. If corporations are not people, they should not be able to hold patents.
Yes.
Even if it's a team that was hired by the corporation by itself should not have the rights of an individual.
Yeah, I'm agreeing with you, Eric. I'm absolutely agreeing with you. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to Chicago's Progressive Talk. Michael in Buford, Georgia. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hello there, Tom. How you doing? I had two things I wanted to bring up. I'm a composer, and so I wanted to speak on the copyright end of things in regards to music.
Okay, go for it.
The first one is, I don't know if you're aware of it, you're out of, your studios are in New York, is that correct?
No, we're in Washington, D.C.
Oh, Washington, okay. Well, there's a new production that has gone up on Broadway recently of Porgy and Bess, opera by the Gershwins.
Right.
Well, the reason why that production has recently gone up is because the title of the show is The Gershwins, Porgy and Bess. The reason why is because Porgy and Bess, the show, just went into the public domain this year.
Wow. So even though the Gershwins are long dead, and nobody's been making money off Porgy and Bess all these years, it's been locked out because the copyright laws have been extended so long, mostly by the lobbying of Disney to keep the mouse.
Right. So the deal is that what they did is that they knew that at this point they couldn't keep the copyright going because it had just gone into public domain. So they went in, they tweaked some of the orchestration, added two new songs from the Gershwin's library, officially re-registered it as The Gershwin's Porgy and Bess, and that's what the new production on Broadway is up as.
And it's so newly and freshly copyrighted.
Exactly. So they've renewed that copyright.
You know, this is government regulations that shouldn't exist. You know, where are my Republicans?
You know, the other tragic thing with Disney, too, is that Disney owns the copyright for the song that came out in the 50s or 60s, The Lion Sleeps Tonight. You know, they have the copyright for that song.
One of my favorite songs of all time.
Yeah, well, the little chanting and stuff that goes in on top of that.
A weem away.
Well, that song was actually recorded in the 1930s by a gentleman who was going through sub-Saharan Africa for the Decca label.
Interesting.
They're actually tribal chants that were recorded by a gentleman who was a recording artist in Kenya at the time.
Right.
And he just recorded it to these people that were on Decca. Well, Decca later sold it to the Disney company, and it, you know, they became, you know, very wealthy off of this song, back in the 50s and 60s. The family back in Africa has not seen a single penny of any of the money that the royalties made off this song, and his surviving family actually all has AIDS. And they could really use the money. They did an entire documentary on it that I really wish I could remember the name of. But it's very tragic.
That's
to
amazing.
See what some of this copyright law has caused for people.
Yeah, and this is very much like the pharmaceutical corporations that travel all around the world talking to Aboriginal people and looking at Aboriginal forests for pharmaceuticals. Half of the entire formulary of the United States is actually herbally based. And a good percentage of that came out of rainforests, where the indigenous people got squat. They got absolutely nothing. And in fact, some of these governments now are starting to say to our pharmaceutical companies, when they come into the country looking for drugs, we're going to assign one of our scientists to follow you around. If you find anything, you're going to have to pay us part of it. Yeah, there's a lot of conversation in Ecuador some years back about doing that. Although I don't know if anybody's actually successfully done it. But Michael, thank you for adding to our body of knowledge about this. That was brilliant. Thanks so much for the call. We'll be back 57 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Where have our Republicans gone? I was talking last hour, humorously, but actually not, said, you know, okay, we've got this government regulation, patent and copyright laws, that enhances the power and wealth of large corporations tremendously, that has inhibited the development of everything from the internet to new pharmaceuticals. India is saying, no, thank you. But we're saying, and we're trying to say to the world, no, we've got to do it on the terms that the multinationals want. I thought Republicans were opposed to regulations. Eh? I thought they were opposed to government welfare, government doing things that make people money. I thought they thought the government should just provide an army so that ExxonMobil can make money shipping oil over here, you know. So, anyhow, the GOP, the Republican Party, I am calling officially now for the real Republicans, the adults in the room, to take back the party. This is a party, the Republican Party, that has gone all just completely off the rails, totally over the edge. When you see a Republican presidential race where Mitt Romney, who never stood for anything in his life longer than about 6 weeks, and is a, you know, other than getting rich and his Mormon faith, which I salute him for. I mean, I salute him for being consistent about something, but that's a little different than having a political philosophy that you can carry with you. And, you know, the Mormons are very philanthropic. I don't see that in the Republican philosophy. So I don't even know where that's going through. But if you go back to 1945, the early 1950s, we came out of a national debt after World War II that was 127% of GDP. It was higher than it is now. It was higher than it's ever been in the history of this country. It cost a lot to defeat Hitler and Tojo. It cost a lot. How did we pay that off? Did Eisenhower come into office in 1952 and say, okay, that's it, we're going to cut all government spending? We're going to cut. Government is too big and too bloated after this giant war where almost everything, almost the entire American economy was converted into wartime production. Our cars, our car assembly lines were making tanks. Our tool and die shops were making parts for tanks. Our clothing shops, factories were making uniforms. Our ladies' nylon factories were making parachutes. You know, it goes on and on and on. I mean, the food production was being diverted. Much of the food was being diverted to K rations and supplies for the GIs over in Europe and in the Asian Pacific Theater. So did FDR, or excuse me, did Dwight Eisenhower come into the Republican with Richard Nixon as his vice president? Did he come into office and say, Eisenhower and Nixon say, okay, it's time to cut the government. We have 127% of our GDP as debt. We've got a bigger debt than we've ever had in history. It's time to cut the government. No, he didn't. Jude Wininsky at that time was just a little kid. He had not yet invented his two Santa Clauses theory, which is held from the inauguration of Ronald Reagan till this very day, which says that when Republicans come into office, spend like a drunken sailor, goose the economy as much as you possibly can, as long as there's a Republican in the White House, run up a huge national debt, and then when a Democrat comes into office, start screaming bloody murder about the national debt and force them to cut spending, which will drive the economy into the tank. So the Democrat in the White House can take the blame for it and lose the next election, and then the Republicans come back in and spend like drunken sailors again and run up the huge debt. And in the meantime, eventually the debt will get so large that the Democrats are going to have to shoot Santa Claus. Santa Claus being Social Security. Now, Judah Wininsky laid this out in the mid 70s. Ronald Reagan ran with it. George Herbert Walker Bush ran with it. Bill Clinton came into office. All of a sudden, it was 8 years of screaming about, oh, the debt! It's going to kill us! Where's the debt clock? The debt clock on New York in Times Square. The debt clock here. Oh, the debt! Oh, the humanity! And then Bill Clinton leaves office, and George W. Bush comes in, and all of a sudden, debt? What debt? Yes! Borrow $2 trillion to fight some wars. Borrow $800 billion to give a drug benefit away to people. Don't put any of it on the budget. Put it all on the credit card. Run a $5 trillion in debt. We don't care. We're Republicans. And then as soon as George W. Bush leaves office and Barack Obama comes in, oh, the humanity of it. Oh, it's the debt. Oh, it's the debt. We've got to do something about the debt. So that was Jude Wininsky's political strategy, his two Santa Clauses theory that he published back in 77, I think it was 78, that the Republicans have been following ever since because it has worked brilliantly for them. But what did they do before Jude Wininsky? They were real Republicans. Dwight Eisenhower came into office, and instead of paying off that huge debt by cutting government programs, so theoretically you'd have extra money, because that's the theory that John Boehner and Eric Cantor are promoting. I mean, the reality is you cut government programs, and what happens? You lay off government workers, unemployment goes up, government costs more because now you've got to pay for food stamps and unemployment benefits, and all those unemployed workers, they're no longer taking a paycheck, they're no longer paying taxes. Tax revenues go down. The deficit gets worse. Austerity produces worse deficits. Want proof? Look at Greece, look at Spain, look at England. Look at 24 states in the United States that are majority controlled by Republicans that have cut spending, cut taxes, and seen their GDP go down and their unemployment rates go up. This is not rocket science. This is Econ 101. So what did Dwight Eisenhower do? He borrowed. Using borrowed money, he built the national highway system, the equivalent of today building a national high-speed rail system. That created a boom for communities all across the nation and for inland manufacturers who wanted to get products out to the ports to ship for export to stimulate the economy and pay down our debt. In 1953, Republican Dwight Eisenhower, created the Department of Health, Education, and Welfare and made it a cabinet position to reduce the number of hungry and poorly educated Americans, thus stimulating the economy and helping to pay down our debt. He pushed for and built the St. Lawrence Seaway, a massive public works project. Connected the Great Lakes to the Atlantic Ocean to build trade with Europe, thus creating manufacturing jobs for export here in the United States, thus stimulating the economy to pay down our debt. He reached out to Alaska and Hawaii and brought them in as states, new taxpayers. He openly supported a top income tax rate of 91% on the very, very rich, which generated revenue to help pay down our debt. He openly supported corporations paying over 30% of all federal taxes, and today it's about 12 to 15%, depending on the year you look at, to help pay down the debt. He pushed for federal R&D, so in 1956, IBM built the first hard drive. In 1960, the laser was invented with largely federal funds. He openly supported unionized workers having the right to organize, which kept pay up, thus increased their income, So the government taxes went up, or revenue rather went up, thus paying down the federal debt. He aggressively defended Social Security and said that the right-wing oil men in Texas who wanted to privatize it were stupid and their number is small. That's a verbatim quote from Eisenhower. In 1956, he pushed for a 25% increase in the minimum wage, further stimulating the economy and helping pay down our debt. He was anti-war. In 1952, when he ran for president, he ran on the platform of vote for Eisenhower, vote for peace. He ended the Korean War. Thus, he stopped the hemorrhaging of money from the United States, brought those GIs back home, put them back to work. And in 1959, he invited Nikita Khrushchev to the United States, thus beginning the process of what we call detente, which kept our military budget from exploding and thus helped pay down the debt. In 1953, he fulfilled his 1952 campaign platform of vote for Eisenhower, vote for peace, by ending the war in Korea. He supported civil rights and strongly supported the Supreme Court decision of Brown versus Board in 1954. In fact, after the break, I'll tell you how he supported that, what he did, and what I want to know is, where are those Republicans?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Republican Party, if Dwight Eisenhower were to pop into the planet today, he would look around and he'd go, Republicans? These aren't Republicans. Oh, they call them Democrats?
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school. And proud. Paleoanthropology.
It's our geeky science alert. I'm going to get back to my Republican rant in less than 2 minutes, but I every week we devote just a few minutes here on Thursdays to my favorite topic, or one of my favorite topics, which is science. I've been a science geek since I was a little kid. And you think global warming produced by excessive carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is just screwing with the climate? Have you noticed how everyone around you is getting fat? Danish scientists, this was first, I'm not sure where this first appeared, but the article that I'm reading is published in the Huffington Post UK edition, and it's written by Kirsty Hazel, or Hazel, H-A-Z-E-L-L. And the headline, which kind of says it all, scientists discover link between carbon dioxide and obesity. Danish scientists have found a link between increasing levels of obesity and carbon dioxide in the air. This isn't like, you know, hold your breath a long time and, you know, or drink a lot of fizzy pop. This is in the air. The researchers found that men with greater CO2 levels in their blood ate 6% more food than those who breathed the normal amount of carbon dioxide. They put them in rooms where they just kind of jacked up the CO2, and guess what? They started getting fat. It also causes the heartbeat to rise. It also affects the brain nerve cells, orexins in the hypothalamus, which among other functions control our appetite. The theory is that the CO2 makes your blood more acidic and your body adapts to that by adding weight, shall we say. We don't want the Keystone XL pipeline because it's going to throw 100 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere and it's going to make us all fatter. I've been trying to get rid of this inch around my waistline for a year now. It's going to be 6 inches if we get the Keystone XL pipeline, right? Okay, back to the Republicans. Dwight Eisenhower, 1954, the Supreme Court said in Brown versus Board of Education, you cannot have separate medical facilities anymore. They rolled back Plessy versus Ferguson from 1898, their own Supreme Court decision. They said that was wrong. They reversed it. That was the separate but equal decision in the late, you know, a couple of years before the beginning of the 20th century, and said, sorry, that's wrong. All facilities have to be equally available to African Americans and white people, or people of any color or race or religion or whatever. So what did the Republican president, Dwight Eisenhower, do? Did he talk about conspiracies and Kenyans and secret Kenyans and Muslims and black professors and just get all hysterical? Like Sarah Palin the other day, oh, he wants to take us back to that time before the Civil War when we were divided by skin color. No. He sent the army down to Arkansas to enforce integration of a college. The Republican president. On his way out of office, the Republican president, Dwight Eisenhower, warned us against the military-industrial complex, which is now bankrupting us. Washington, D.C., the suburbs around Washington, D.C. are now, they've beaten out Beverly Hills. There's more millionaires here than anywhere else in the United States. The richest zip codes are now in the Beltway. Why? Because lobbyists start at $325,000 a year. If you're a former member of Congress, you start lobbying at $1 million a year. If you're a former U.S. senator, you start lobbying at $2 to $5 million a year. Lobbyists make a friggin' fortune. Why? Because they're handling fortunes. Because a billionaire knows, or a billion-dollar, multi-billion-dollar corporation, $100 billion, $500 billion corporation, knows that if they drop, you know, 30, 40, 50, 60 million bucks on lobbying, buying members of Congress, taking them on dinners, flying them over to Scotland to go golfing, taking them out to Hawaii and helicoptering them over the volcanoes and giving them just a wonderful time. Take them to one of those islands where Tom DeLay used to go, where they locked up the workers behind chain link fences and I want to say Samoa. It's not. Anyhow, whatever the islands were, and force them into prostitution, and there's some questions about what Tom DeLay and all his buddies were doing there. The Mariana Islands. Thank you, Jacob. You're absolutely right. But it's a U.S. territory, so you could sew made in the USA and the labels when you make the clothes there and ship them back here, so they sell for a better price, right? So, anyhow, these people are making it. So there's all this money in this town. Because if you spend $50 million lobbying, and only $45 million of it makes its way to the lawmakers, and $5 million of it sticks to the fingers of the lobbyists, that's fine, because that $45 million going to the lobbyists, or to the lawmakers rather, is going to cause them to pass laws that aren't going to make you $45 million. They're going to make you $1 billion. Lobbying is the best investment you can make, period, bar none. I mean, you got to have a multi-million or multi-billion-dollar company to begin with, but if you do, if you can afford to buy a lawmaker for a couple $1 million, if you're Foster Freeze and you can give Rick Santorum $10 million, if you're, or whatever it was, if you're Shelley Adelson and you can give Newt Gingrich $10 million, you're going to make that back easy. In fact, Foster Freeze, the sugar daddy for Rick Santorum, Foster Freeze was at that secret meeting of billionaires that the Koch brothers had a few months back out west. And according to people who were there, he stood up and he said, and he has not refuted this, it's been widely publicized in the press. He said, where's the effect of? He was making an investment in Rick Santorum. And you guys should make an investment in any of these Republican candidates, because if any of these Republicans become president, you will see a return on your investment. Now, that doesn't mean you get your investment back. It means you get your investment back with a profit. Dwight Eisenhower would have nothing to do with that. All of the things that Dwight Eisenhower did back then, building the National Highway System, building the St. Lawrence Seaway, building roads across America, building bridges across America, building hospitals across America, building schools across America, strengthening our public education system, ending integration, or to a large extent, ending it to the extent that he could. He didn't have the happiest Congress during that time, at least with regard to that issue. Right? This was back in the days when Strom Thurmond would still filibuster things in the Senate, and he did right through the 60s. All of those were considered conservative issues and pro-American. David Cameron, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, had something to say about what it means to be a conservative. I'll play that clip after the break, and we'll take your calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And my question is, what has happened to those Republicans? Are they hiding? Okay, so I was asking yesterday, we went through this list of 35 things that Democrats had brought us, from Social Security to Medicare to Medicaid to welfare benefits to unemployment insurance to the National Labor Relations Act to the 40-hour work week to the 5-day work week to the medical leave bill, to the prevention of child labor, to the minimum wage. I mean, it just goes on and on and on, to making sure that your air is clean, your food is clean, your water's clean, that your sewage is properly done, that our rivers are not like catching on fire anymore. On and on the list goes, all Democrats. And I said, please name one thing the Republicans have done. And we have a viewer rant line. You can get to it over at TomHartman.com. And you can also drop into our live free chat room. All this, and you can build your own blogs and your own message boards. It's all free, and it's all commercial free. It's all everything free. It's really cool stuff, and it's all over at TomHartman.com. And so somebody went over and left a message on our listener rant line, and this is what he or she said. She said, I believe it is.
Tom Hartman asked what the Republicans, have they done anything? The only thing I can think of is Ronald Reagan did pass the COBRA Act, which if you lost your job or got divorced, you could continue health care at exorbitant costs, but at least it was available. That's the only thing I can think of, and even then it's not that great. Thanks.
Close. Excuse me, I'm sneezing here. Close, but no cigar. In 1986, the House of Representatives was controlled by Democrats. Thomas O'Neill, was the Speaker of the House. He famously got along very well with Ronald Reagan. But the COBRA is an acronym for the Consolidated Omnibus Budget Reconciliation Act, if my memory serves me correctly. And so it was a giant budget bill, and they just, you know, people would jam things in. Sometimes it's called pork. And one of the things that got jammed in by the Democrats was that if you lose your job, you can keep your health insurance. Ronald Reagan did sign it into law. He had no choice. It was the budget act for the year. And if he wanted to keep the federal government going, he had to sign it. Now, how he felt about COBRA itself, I frankly don't know. He might have been supportive of it. He might not have been. But this was not a Republican initiative. This was a Democratic initiative. Similarly, you know, the thing that blows my mind is that the Republicans are beating the drums for war in Iran. They're beating the drums for war. And back 10 years ago, they were beating the drums for war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Absolutely unnecessary, absolutely stupid wars that have harmed this nation, bankrupted this nation, destroyed, broken the lives, and ended the lives of so many of our troops. And millions of Afghans and Iraqis. The Republican Party historically was the party of peace. Go all the way back to the Federalists. The Federalists were the first conservative party. John Adams was their first president. Washington was sort of a Federalist, but when he was elected, there were no parties. So Adams was our first conservative president, the Federalist. And then he was followed by Jefferson, who was an anti-Federalist, a Democratic Republican. He was the first, the modern-day Democratic Party, started with Thomas Jefferson. But anyhow, John Adams, the first Federalist. The Federalist Party in the War of 1812, now this was on James Madison's presidency, as I recall, the War of 1812, in fact, James Madison was the only president to lead troops while president. He left the White House to go fight the British and the Canadians, and Dolly famously took the picture of George Washington and rolled it up and smuggled it out of the White House before the British burned the White House. So anyhow, the War of 1812 was opposed by who? The Federalists, because they were conservatives. They said, we're conservatives, we don't like wars. Abraham Lincoln, when President Polk declared the Mexican-American War, Abraham Lincoln came out and said, this is wrong. In fact, I actually have his quote here someplace. He said, it is a fact that the United States Army, in marching to the Rio Grande, marched into a peaceful Mexican settlement and frightened the inhabitants away from their homes and their growing crops. He opposed the war. He called on President Polk for proof that the war was necessary. Lincoln said in Congress, quote, he was at that time a congressman from Illinois. He said, quote, that soil is not ours. And Congress did not annex it or attempt to annex it. He voted for a resolution declaring the war unnecessary and accusing Polk of violating the Constitution and starting it. Republican, the first Republican to run for president, or the first Republican president. Actually, they had one candidate before that, but. The Republicans were opposed to the Mexican-American War. They were the conservatives were opposed to the War of 1812. They were opposed to World War I. Glenn Beck still rails about how Woodrow Wilson got us into World War I with Edward Bernays' help, the nephew of Sigmund Freud, you know. Wink, wink. World War II, another Democrat war, to use the Republican phrase. My dad was an Eisenhower Republican. He used to refer to the Democratic Party as the War Party. Because they started because they got us into World War I, they got us into World War II, Harry Truman got us into the Korean War, Lyndon Johnson got us into the Vietnam War, the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution in 1964. The Democratic Party was always the party of war. The Republican Party was always the party of peace. Richard Nixon won re-election in 1974 on a platform of what? Peace! He had a secret plan to end the Vietnam War. Dwight Eisenhower won the presidency in 1952 on a platform of what? Peace! You've got the clip of that someplace there, Jacob. Do you have it?
He has met Europe's leaders, has got them working with us. elect the number one man for the number one job of our time. November 4th, vote for peace. Vote for Eisenhower.
A paid film.
A paid film. There you go. I mean, that was his campaign. The Republicans were the peace party. And now you turn on Fox News and here's, you know, John McCain going, bomb, 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 Iran. We need war. We need more war. Whatever happened to that? Here's some quotes from some Republicans before World War II. This is before World War II. This is while Hitler was gassing Jews and invading, he had already invaded Czechoslovakia and Poland, and this was the debate on the floor of the United States House of Representatives and Senate. These are all Republicans, every single one of them. The source of these is Rex Stout's book, The Illustrious Dunderheads. George Dondero, the Republican congressman from Michigan. Think your vote over seriously tonight, my colleagues, because this may be your last chance to cast a vote for war or peace. Constitutionally declared wars are out of date. War today is by presidential or dictatorial decree, not by the voice of the people. Here's Representative Fred Bradley, the Republican congressman from Michigan. They opposed our entering World War II. Oh, excuse me. That was Fred Bradley. Here's Representative Dondero of Michigan. We are not at war, and no nation has even suggested or insinuated that we are to become the object of its wrath unless we provoke it. Representative Hamilton Fish, the Republican from New York. We have much more to fear from the war makers than from our enemies abroad. That would be Hitler. He did not want Franklin Roosevelt to go into that war in World War II. Republican Congressman Louis Ludlow of Indiana. This is in the 1940s. This is like 44, thereabouts, early 40s. We have much more to fear from the war maker. Oh, I said that. The interventionist tells us that appeasement is a horrid word. They would have us believe that appeasement to end war is wrong. But appeasement to keep war going is perfectly all right. That was Congressman Daniel Reed of New York. Representative Dewey Short of Missouri. When our young men must be called upon to go... Must our young men be called upon to go 3,000 miles to sacrifice their lives for inept leaders, foreign warlords, and profiteers? Is the American youth to be led to the slaughter by the paid propaganda of those two who would barter blood for financial profit? Republican from Missouri, arguing against going to war with Hitler. Dwight Eisenhower, in 1952, running for president. Little did we ever realize that we would live to see the hour when a president in time of peace, when no one has attacked us and no one has assaulted us. He's speaking of Truman here and the Korean War, would ask the American people to grant him the dictatorial power to conscript the young manhood of this nation in order that they may goose step up to the commands of the generals and salute brass hats. That was Dwight Eisenhower talking about the Korean War. Where are these Republicans? Other than Ron Paul. And he's nuts. He wants to do away with Social Security and public education. Matt in Chicago, listening on WCPT. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, how's it going? I am a 18-year-old senior student of AP government, and we've been doing a lot of studying recently of the modern presidents. And we have just finished learning about Dwight Eisenhower, and I've been paying a lot of attention recently to what's been going on. And, wow, Eisenhower is a different kind of a Republican.
Well, he's a guy who actually saw men die in war.
Yeah.
He knew what hell war was. George W. Bush joined the Champaign unit of the Texas Air National Guard, spent the last year and a half or the last year and a month AWOL, drunk in Alabama, working with Karl Rove on a political campaign. And you know, never saw war, never saw a man die, never saw what war was really like. And so to him, it was a video game. Hey, yeah, let's have a war.
Right. Yeah, that's mind-blowing. Yeah. Well, anyway, I guess what I'm trying to get at is just what we've learned about Eisenhower, I feel like he's just an incredibly underrated president.
Yep.
His farewell speech has been completely lost in history. Because of JFK's inauguration.
Yep.
I don't know. He's just something else.
And, he is. Matt, in honor of you and your call, I will play a clip from Dwight Eisenhower's farewell speech when we come back on the other side of the break, and then we'll try and get in some of the dozen or so phone calls we've got waiting on hold. We'll be right back. Matt, thank you very much for the call. Say hi to your AP class and to your teacher for me. Good on you for listening to the program. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
45 minutes past the hour. Where are the Republicans that Dwight Eisenhower would recognize, or even Richard Nixon would recognize? To the program where we dare to ask the question, is Walmart a person? Is Boeing a person? Is Blackwater a person? And we dare to say, no, don't think so. Not a chance. Not a chance. Are we close to finding that, Jacob? Yeah, you got it? Okay. In honor of Matt, our last caller, here is Dwight Eisenhower, 1961, his farewell just before John Kennedy took office. The last president had an opportunity to say goodbye. And here's what Dwight Eisenhower said as he left office.
Until the latest of our world conflicts, the United States had no armaments industry. American makers of plowshares could, with time and as required, make swords as well. But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications. Our toil, resources, and livelihood are all involved. So is the very structure of our society. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes. We should take nothing for granted. Only an alert and knowledgeable citizenry can compel the proper meshing of the huge industrial and military machinery of defense with our peaceful methods and goals, so that security and liberty may prosper together.
There you go, in its entire context. Brilliant. Joe in Spokane. Hey, Joe, what's up?
Hi, you were wondering where the sane Republicans went.
Yes, sir, where'd they go?
We became Democrats.
Oh, you're one of them?
Yeah.
You were
my folks were Eisenhower Republicans. I was a Nixon Republican.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I'm a solid Democrat now.
Yeah. And isn't it a kind of a sad commentary on America that the Democratic Party, I mean, the Democratic Party still has a strong progressive faction. You know, Jan Schakowsky, one of the great leaders of that. I was going to say Bernie Sanders, but he's an independent. But Sherrod Brown, another one of the strong progressives. I mean, there's a number of very, very good progressives in the United States Senate and the House of Representatives. But by and large, because the Republican Party is so strong, most of the legislation that the Democrats are able to get through is legislation that would have been passed by Richard Nixon.
Yeah.
You know, Richard Nixon proposed a health care plan that was virtually identical to Obamacare. And,
yeah.
And you know, President Obama, when he was campaigning for president, said he wanted a single-payer plan. But, you know, you get what you can get through Congress, and at least he got something through Congress, but you know, even though it was Nixon's plan. But it's like
yeah, they keep calling it Romney's plan, but it's almost, if you go back and
that
look
was Nixon's
at what
plan.
Nixon laid out, it's It's Nixon's plan.
Yeah, they're absolutely identical. Okay, Joe, thanks a lot. Well, glad to have you. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. Michael in the Bronx in New York City, listening on WWRL. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Tom, how you doing? Great talk to you again. I don't know if you remember, but we had met in that coffee party meeting. I was the one that asked about the impeachment of the Supreme Court.
Oh, yeah, a year or so ago when Lawrence Lessig and I both spoke.
Exactly,
yeah,
exactly.
In Manhattan.
I remember.
I do remember,
yes,
yeah. So what's
okay.
up?
I was so intrigued while I was driving home from work listening to you speaking out about the Republican complaints, which are hypocrisies in the economy. I just wanted to add to the list when it comes to the issue of the Rush Limbaugh, and they're complaining about, A, that Democrats are trying to suppress their First Amendment rights, which is a falsehood. But
nobody's asking for the government to intervene in Limbaugh's case, which would be in a violation of the First Amendment. The First Amendment protects us from government interference in our right to speech, not corporate
exactly.
interference.
Exactly, but then it's funny how none of them ever gave a hoot about Sandra Fluke's First Amendment rights and speaking out about the contraception and how it serves more than just birth control or any kind
right.
of procreation.
Right.
They always say that they're always advocating for invading our First Amendment, our Fourth Amendment rights, but then when the you-know-what hits the fan against them, now it's a private issue. You can't cross them to their right to privacy.
Yeah. But let me just add, Michael, I am very concerned that this advertiser boycott against Limbaugh is going to hurt all of talk radio, because a lot of these advertisers are going to get, have been burned by advertising on Limbaugh's show, and they're just thinking, okay, talk radio, you never know what the host is going to say, left or right. People can say inflammatory things, and so we're just going to pull all of our talk radio advertising. And that could seriously hurt progressive talk radio as well. The way to get a host off the air, or on the air for that matter, in a particular market or on a particular station is not to go after their advertisers. It's to call the radio stations and talk to the program directors, the people who make the decisions about what shows are carried and which ones aren't, and say either I want this show or I don't want that show. And if they hear from enough people, they'll say, hey, there's an audience out there. I should be providing programming for that audience. Or this audience is fed up with this programming. I should be looking for something else. And Mike Huckabee is rolling out a show in the noon to three day part, which is Rush Limbaugh's day part, sometime in the next few weeks. And he's got to be licking his chops right now. But, the advertiser boycott thing could backfire very, very badly on progressive talk radio. So I wish somebody had consulted somebody actually in talk radio before that whole campaign started. Because, all of us need to be supporting our advertisers. Michael, thank you very much for listening to WWRL. And thanks for calling in. Good to hear from you again after the coffee party.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I saw the most amazing thing the other day in one of the science publications. They have taken a picture of a vibrating atom. Atoms vibrating within a molecule. Dr. Cosmin Blaga is with us. He is a research fellow at the OSU Atomic Physics Research the Ohio State University Department of Physics Atomic Physics Research Group, physics.ohio-state.edu. And Dr. Blaga, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us. I just found this amazing that we were able to take a picture of an atom and that it was vibrating. First of all, the picture. How is this done?
Well, so we have a very powerful laser that would focus into a vacuum chamber where the molecules are leaked into, and the laser first removes an electron from a molecule, and then within a very, very short time, about a laser cycle, it drives the electron back to the molecule. And it scatters on it, basically diffracts, and then looking at the angles at which the electrons are scattered after they hit the molecule, we detect these electrons, and then we look at which angle they're.
So you're looking at the scattered. at the burst of photons that come from that.
No, there are no photons. Well, the laser is just the laser has the photons. It's basically we're looking at an electron signal. So it's one molecule and one electron.
Right.
So.
So this way, so an analogy would not be taking a piece of flint, a piece of granite, and hitting them together and watching the sparks.
No, probably not.
Okay.
I would say that basically what we want to do is we want to be able to see chemical reactions take place.
Mm-hmm.
And these reactions, they right now, up until now, we put certain reactants together and then we look what comes out. But there's no way to control what comes out. It always comes out the same thing.
Sure.
So what we want to do, we want to actually control the chemical reaction, but to do so, you have to supply the molecule with the information fast enough to, you know, do what you want to do during the chemical reaction, which is very, very fast.
Right. One of the most amazing and fascinating parts of physics for me, is this whole idea of vibration, the idea that without constant movement, these particles might cease to be particles. They might be something other than a particle. They might just be energy. That possibly all matter in the universe is simply resonance. It's simply music. It's simply vibration. Is there any? Am I blithering here, or is there some reality to that?
No. There is. This is. The big experiments that everybody's very excited about. That's going on at LHC, this large collider in Switzerland, and they're looking for the God's particle, the Higgs boson.
Right.
That's exactly what that is. They're looking for a particle that gives rise to all the mass. And that particle, yes, the fundamental particle, it's a quantum object. So it's a field in a sense. So it is a wave. So yeah, you're right.
Right. So the foundational. So if you look at, I'm looking at my hand right now. My hand is made up of complex pieces of tissue that are made up of molecules, that are made up of atoms, that are made up of subatomic particles.
That's right.
And as we work down the chain of subatomic particles through quarks and leptons and all those other things, we eventually reach the most subtle, the smallest piece out of which all these larger pieces are made. And that smallest piece out of which all matter is made isn't actually matter. It's a wave. It's a vibration.
That's right. They call them. This is you're talking probably about the string theory. Yes.
Yes. And so if that's true, then everything that we see that we think is actual physical reality is simply illusion. Would be the wrong word. Maybe Maya, the old Hindu term, but. It is the appearance, and by appearance, I don't mean just mean to look at it. You can actually hit it, and it makes noise and things. But really, it's the consequence, let's say, of this symphony, all these different vibrational frequencies of these different fields accumulating in ways that we call subatomic particles, atoms, and molecules. Is that right?
That's correct. It's just. Symphony probably in the quantum world, it's a little, maybe not the right word. It's a lot of noise.
No, I get it.
Yeah.
And maybe more like a construction site.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's very noisy.
Yeah. But the thing that has amazed me is the metaphysical, and that's really the wrong word because that suggests things like spirits and gods and things like that. But I lack a better word for it. The metaphysical dimension of this, that if that subtlest particle is energy, and if thought is energy, and if love is energy, and all these other things are energy, might there be, they're simply resonant frequencies within our brain, the consequence of chemical reactions, we know, might there be some association between consciousness, and maybe by consciousness I'm using a word that as humans we can't even comprehend, and... You know, in other words, if our consciousness could resonate at the frequency of that Higgs boson, might we suddenly, literally, be able to perceive the entire universe?
Yeah, there's actually a school of thought about this one, and if I'm not mistaken, there's someone in Portland, a physicist, that he actually is. I don't remember right now his name from the top of my head, but he. Yeah, that's what he thinks.
Yeah.
We're trying to stay not to touch that much into, you know, keep the science separate from the metaphysics,
And I honor that. I absolutely understand and honor that. But I, you know, personally, I mean, this is, since I was a preteen,
mm-hmm.
This is, you know, I had an older cousin, a couple of years older than me, who introduced me to Einstein's theory of relativity and then the time and mass dilation theories mm-hmm. and the equations and taught me how to do those equations when I was around 8 or 9 years old. And, you know, we would push these things out and say, okay, this is, you know, this is the point at which, well, you know, the speed of light squared, the point at which, you know, mass becomes infinite, time collapses to zero, or was it the other way around? And at that time, we were having, my cousin Joe and I were having these conversations about the possibility that the entire universe was just a thought, that it was just an idea, or that at some level, all matter being made out of energy, as Einstein pretty much demonstrated, what was that energy? And, you know, because we can perceive energy, very, very small slices of the spectrums of energy. We can perceive sound, we can perceive gravity, we can perceive, which may or may not be energy, I suppose, we can perceive visual spectrum. So I just thought this was the coolest thing, and that you guys were able to actually see an atom, and sure enough, it was vibrating. Does an atom always have the same resonant frequency, or do they vibrate at different frequencies?
No, every molecule has its own spectrum, and that's actually one way that we see what stars and stuff it's made of. You know, you just look and see what colors they comes from them, and then you know exactly what molecules it's in that cloud.
So each atom ultimately, because the atoms are making up the molecules. So you can say, okay, there's a lot of hydrogen in that one. There's more oxygen in that one. There's more nitrogen in that one, or more metals. You know, there's a lot of copper there, or something like that.
Yeah.
And the same reason, thus, when we send up fireworks and we look at them and oh, look at it's green.
That's
copper.
Right. That's right.
Yeah.
That's where they get the colors.
Yeah. Yeah, which are simply resonant frequencies.
Right, it's called the characteristic spectrum. Right, and that's how you see the xenon lights and the headlights, the bluish ones.
Right, and why neon is different colors and all
that's
this.
Right.
All this
right.
Cool stuff. Dr. Cosmin Blaga of Ohio State University, a postdoctoral research fellow in physics there, physics.ohio-state.edu. Thank you so much for sharing this with us.
Thank you, Tom.
It's been a great conversation. I find this stuff fascinating. Thank you again. 15 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, we've argued a lot of religion on this program over the years. You now know my religion. We'll be back.
Science rocks. Science rocks. Science rocks. You better believe me. Science rocks.
Welcome back, Talk Media for the sane among us. Tom Hartman here with you. I'm still curious where these Republicans went. We took a moment out there. I guess we had two geeky science alerts today. I just couldn't resist it when I saw that article and that photo of that atom, and it said, oh, by the way, it's vibrating. And I was like, Eureka! I knew it! Robert in Bloomington, Indiana. Hey, Robert, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, about that vibrating atom.
Mm-hmm.
We study the effect of
who's we?
There's a group of us.
Mm-hmm. Are you a physicist?
No, we're you could say spiritualist, but it's not religion.
Mm-hmm. So you're a metaphysicist.
Well, more than that, mm-hmm. What we can do, what we have been shown to do, is to concentrate on a place inside of ourselves that transports you into that energy field.
Mm-hmm.
And it works. I mean, I've done this now 40 years.
Yeah.
And the man who is in charge is named Prem Rawat. Mm-hmm. And he has a website on the internet, and WOPG.org.
Okay.
And he's given this away for free.
You familiar with Thomas Sugrue's book, There Is a River, about Edgar Cayce?
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, this. I read that when I was a teenager, and it was like,
If you go back in Cayce, he names a person and a time in history and a place on the earth where the global Messiah will be born.
Yeah. Now, see, all of that, I find all that fascinating, and I found Edgar Cayce's You know, the regressions that he was able to do, where he would go back into people's previous lives and the healings and all that. And so much of it was solid and so much of it was true, and the ARE is still there and they're still doing it, and I found it amazing. But it's like, it goes beyond my theology, my religious worldview pretty much stops at, not stops, but the semi-permeable boundary of it is, it's all one, it's all vibrating, it's all consciousness.
Absolutely.
And if
Absolutely.
We can become sufficiently conscious, we can become part of all of it, and that's called Satchitananda, that's called bliss, that's called enlightenment.
That's what
Jesus was talking about, it's what Buddha was talking about, it's what Thich Nhat Hanh was talking about, it's what you know, Isaac Luria was talking about, and it just goes on and on. Robert, thank you very much.
Are you interested in that?
I will check it up. Check it out. Thank you for the website. I appreciate it. Wendy, I believe it is, in Palatine, Illinois, listening on WCPT.
That's Wendell.
Oh,
that's
Wendell. I'm sorry. Okay. I saw that, Ellen.
First
I thought that's got to be a typo. Hey, Wendell.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
Tom, when science gets to know the inner workings of the universe, it makes me believe more in God. Just like you just said, that at the basic level of everything, it's sound waves.
Well, vibration. Vibration is one kind of sound, but so is light.
Yeah, and that goes in the beginning when God said he created the earth. He spoke it into being. And that makes me go again to believe that the Bible, he spoke it to me. And
he vibrated it into being. Yeah, I said.
He vibrated it into being. So,
yeah.
And that goes without limited knowledge.
But just like our last caller,
time,
what you're doing is you're taking this bit of what I would call science and turning it into or using it to validate your theological perspective, which is fine. I honor that. And I think all of us should do that. Anybody who is religiously inclined should do that, because what it does is it opens up religion. It makes it bigger than itself. And it frankly, I think, makes it more inclusive. Because we've always been vibrating, right? The 5 billion years that this planet is old, 15 billion years that the universe is old, it all started with one, you know, little tiny vibration someplace, and boom, it all came into being. But that doesn't necessarily mean that any particular book has the right answer. Go ahead.
I'm not saying that. I'm saying that I don't believe, you know, that is, you know, our limited knowledge back then, whatever the God was, our limited knowledge only put it in the scope of our understanding.
Yeah, yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Whatever books
yep.
that were made were put
and that's,
into
and that's And that's exactly what we try to do with religions constantly, is try to make sense out of things. I mean, you know, back in the old days, it was, look at that, lightning going across the sky. They didn't call it lightning. That must be a thunderbolt being thrown by Thor, the thunder god. Go ahead.
The Bible never speaks into things of that nature. The Bible never speaks into things of like Thor and lightning and things.
It does. Look at all the things that happened on behalf of Moses, you know, from the plague of frogs to the Red Sea parting and all these other things that might have been natural phenomena, or they might have been, associated with earthquakes or tectonic activity in the region at the time. And he happened to be the guy who was the kind of guru of the day who got all the credit for it. Just like whoever was the first guy to come up with the idea of climbing up on a mountaintop on the shortest day of the year, December 23rd, 24th, in Northern Europe, and lighting a pine tree on fire to reignite the sun, we've got to be the grand poobah for the next, in fact, created a tradition that has lasted for centuries and arguably millennia. But, I find it fascinating. Thank you very much, Wendell, for the call. Mark in Mammoth Lake, California. Hey, Mark, thanks. What's up?
Hello, Tom. I got an idea I wanted to run by you.
Sure.
Regarding the nuclear threat from Iran?
Yeah, I don't think there is a threat, but yes.
Well, the imminent nuclear threat. Has anybody considered we just sell them the nuclear technology they need for peaceful purposes, such as power generation?
We already did that. You know, one of the major suppliers to Iran back when they were under boycott, before George Bush took office, was a company called Halliburton that was run by a guy named Dick Cheney.
Yes, I've heard of Halliburton and Dick Cheney.
Look it up. Dick Cheney was breaking those embargoes and was selling stuff to Iran, was selling stuff to Iraq. Probably some significant portion of Iran's nuclear technology did come from us. But my personal opinion is that if Iran, even if Iran were to get a bomb, which I think is a long way away, even if they were to get a bomb, they are not suicidal. They've got more than 40 military bases within 100 miles of them. We've got all, you know, a destroyer fleet, a aircraft carrier fleet off the coast, the nuclear-powered submarines that could vaporize the entire country. Israel's got a couple of hundred nukes. They're not crazy. What they're trying to do is get a bomb so they can say to us, don't you dare invade our country or we'll take you out. That's what's going on. Thanks, Mark, for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Coming up next, the good, the bad, and the new vocabulary word ugly, and your calls right after this. Yep, that's the good, the bad, and the very, very philanthropiciously ugly. Brought to you by EdisonFactor.com. Food for your brain. The good. New Hampshire legislature. Yesterday, the New Hampshire House of Representatives defeated the so-called License to Discriminate bill. The bill would have allowed state businesses to openly discriminate against same-sex married couples on the basis of that business's religious freedom. In fact, the bill was so poorly worded that it would have also allowed for discrimination against interracial married couples and different faith couples. All across the country, individual rights are under attack. It's nice to see that New Hampshire decided to stand up for our freedoms rather than further infringe upon them. The bad. Ricky Santorum. While campaigning in Puerto Rico this weekend, Santorum was asked by the local paper El Vocero if he supported Puerto Ricans' right to self-determination when it comes to becoming a state. Santorum told the paper that he did not support a state in which English was not the primary language, saying, like any other state, there has to be compliance with this and any other federal law. However, the Constitution does not designate English as the official language of the United States, nor does it say a territory must adopt English as its primary language to become a state. You would think someone running for president would know a little more about the supreme law of the land. And the very, very ugly Arizona State Republicans. Just when you thought Arizona Republicans couldn't create any more ridiculous pieces of legislation, they've done it again. State Republicans are working on yet another birther bill, which is the latest attempt by Arizona Republicans to try and prove that President Obama is not an American citizen. America's economy is a mess. Our healthcare system is broken. Americans everywhere are just trying to get by. And rather than try to help solve America's pressing problems, the Republicans in Arizona are wasting valuable time on a mythical witch hunt. And that is very, very ugly. Amazing. Amazing. Wally, in Vashon Island, Washington, listening on AM 1090. Hey, Wally, what's on your mind?
Tom, I enjoyed that little interview you had. I missed most of it, but I have my own theory. In fact, last night I was watching the History Channel. I think I've seen this before, a special on Einstein, who used thought as his way of establishing his theories.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things he said, I would like to think about how God would have created this. It's kind of a metaphysical way to go into what became quantum mechanics.
Mm-hmm.
But I would like to postulate that the metaphysical, our physical, and the quantum mechanic world that he was talking about are of different dimensions, and that we live in this in-between dimension that we have, this physical world. But we do have a small amount of contact with this spiritual or metaphysical world.
Kind of bleeding and through on either edge, you mean?
Right, and also with the quantum world where we see light feel the vibrations of the universe to some extent and gravity. Mm. So we have some contact with these. But I would suggest that if you got into the metaphysical world, you would no longer find a vibrational world. You would find a smooth world that doesn't exist in our time and space
Well, this was the point that I made to him, was that if you could perceive the universe at the level of the most subtle particle, that particle out of which everything, including the nothing in the universe, everything is made, then if you could see that, what you would see is everything is solid. Everything is one thing. It's all just one giant thing, and we are part of it.
I'm postulating somewhat the opposite, Tom, that
there's an I and a thou, that there's a
there's
me and a that.
A fullness of everything that exists on a level that isn't contained in our space-time continuum, but a completely different dimension.
Why do we need another dimension?
We don't understand. That's why we don't understand it, Tom. Uh-huh. That's why we don't understand. Just as the physicists, when they start trying to find these particles and where they exist, they don't exist where they are from one moment to the other. They change from one place to another place, to a particle, to a piece of to energy, without a transition in between. They exist here, then they exist
you're,
there.
You're familiar with the famous photon through the slit experiment?
Yes.
Let me just explain this for our listeners or viewers who may not be familiar with this. This goes back like 20 years, 30 years. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah.
If you know, a photon is a particle of light, and it can behave like a particle, or it can behave like a wave. And if you beam it at a single slit, it will behave like one or the other, I forget which one, when it hits a phosphorus panel on the other end. On the other hand, if you beam it through two slits, some will be particles. I'm mangling this. It's been a lot of years since I read this. Some will be particles and some will be waves. But the amazing thing is that if you observe it in the process of going through them, it snaps all into one form, either particles or waves. The observer effect. I've really mangled this now, and our caller just dropped. So. The whole, you know, is Heisenberg's uncertainty principle that the observer is modifying the reality. And so how can we know what reality is if all the time, every time we look at it, we modify it? And it becomes something else for us because it knows that we're observing it. And, I mean, there's some pretty amazing stuff with regard to all this stuff. Mary Beth, listening in WCPT in Sox Lake, Illinois. Hey, Mary Beth, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I thought I'd bring up homeopathic medicine.
Yeah.
Because that's actually based on vibration.
I agree. I took a 2-year correspondence course on it. and I still remember, you know, lycopodium and sulf. And...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in fact, we're one of the few countries that doesn't use it regularly.
Yeah, well, I use it.
I know. I do, too. But it's based on vibration, and it's not out there in metaphysical land.
Yeah. There's some actually very, very good science on homeopathy. Or at least what asserts itself as good science. And what's particularly interesting is that the British royal family uses homeopathy and has ever since the days of Samuel Hahnemann in the mid-19th century. And, Prince Charles seems to be doing pretty well with all of his homeopathic remedies. So thank you very much.
They're pretty awesome. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great show, by the way.
Thank you. Thanks for pointing that out, Mary Beth. Ryan in Oswego, Illinois, listening to WCPT. Hey, Ryan, what's up?
Hi, how's it going, Tom?
Great.
I just wanted to bring up a point that I've been thinking about while listening to this, and actually, I'm only 20, so I'm young, you know, I don't have as much knowledge on all this, but I've been learning about quantum mechanics a lot, and you implied understanding the most basic object of the universe, possibly understanding the universe completely, and I wanted to, are you familiar with Ralph Waldo Emerson's Nature essay?
Yes, and it's although I admit it, when I read them, I was your age, which was a long time ago. So, but yeah, I've read a lot of Emerson and a lot of Thoreau. The Transcendentalists were among my favorite reads when I was a teenager.
Yeah, and one of the quotes that are two quotes from Nature specifically, Ralph Waldo Emerson mentions one thing that maybe humans don't want to find the answers. Maybe. The answer is possibly a means to an end of something. Mm. And also he poses another question that the universe is not necessarily a play place, and it's more of an experience. And I understand what you're saying, and I really appreciate where you go with when you talk about understanding as a means for eventual conscious awakening, possibly bliss, in the most definitive sense of the term. But do you see any negative consequences of the understanding which you're implying?
No. A friend of mine actually had this experience. His name is Michael Hutchison. People usually put an N in there, but it's Hutchison, not Hutchinson.
Okay.
And you can Google him. There's he tells his story over at TomHartmann.com. In fact, just plug in Michael Hutchison, Hutchison. And some 15 years ago or so, he was out running, and he fell over a bridge and broke his neck and ended up in a wheelchair as a quadriplegic. And decided, he had been a student of meditation for years and years, and just decided to make that his ashram, that he was now forced to sit and meditate. He couldn't do anything else. And over a period of about a year, he suddenly had this, not quite suddenly, but he had this experience of just merging, melting into the entire universe and becoming one with everything and being filled with bliss, and has been hanging out in that place for the last 15 years. You can correspond with him. You can send him notes. He'll answer you. You'll go visit him. He lives in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He's an amazing, amazing guy. And I've been supporting him.
An overwhelming bliss.
Yeah, and I've been supporting him for a number of years this way, and you know, as an old friend, because he's living on Social Security. I mean, he's living in total poverty.
Yeah.
And he said, you know, I'm the poorest man in the world, but I'm one of the happiest men in the world. And the way that he explained it to me was not that you see the universe, but rather that you become the universe. That it's like the distinction between seer and seen vanishes, and it's all one. And it's like you know, you watch a movie, and in the middle of the movie you get so caught up in it that you think, wow, this is, you know, that your heart starts racing. It's like it's suddenly real.
Yeah.
And then you look around the room, something happens, and you look around the room, and all of a sudden it all collapses down into reality, and I'm in a movie. And you know, Michael is like, he reached the point where he could see that it's all a movie, and, you know, became the observer, became the consciousness of it all. It's really quite remarkable. I encourage you to check it out. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program. Visit TomHartmann.com for audio and video archives.
In fact, we've had Michael on the show as a guest. It's been a lot of years. We should do it again. We'll be back with Senator Sherrod Brown from Ohio in a few minutes, and more of your thoughts.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of decay, democracy is coming to the USA.
Welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And Senator Sherrod Brown, brown.senate.gov is his website, is on the line with us. And Senator Brown, welcome back to the program.
Good to be back. Thanks.
It's great to have you with us. I just have to share this very short anecdote with you, and I hope it's okay. It's about electoral politics. Ellen Ratner shares offices with us, the Talk Radio News Service, and she just came in a few minutes ago and said to say hi to you and that she is rooting for you to beat her crazy cousin.
Okay. Good words. I mean, Ellen loves her family, but my opponent is basically a Tea Party guy. He married into Ellen's family, and Ellen is, I appreciate her publicly rooting for me. I know she does, and I appreciate that. Ellen stands for the right brand of politics to move this country forward. It's made us a success.
So. Yeah, Ellen is
exactly
a good, solid progressive. So you are working on how to get more jobs to Ohio, and not just Ohio, the whole nation, but, of course, you're from Ohio. That's kind of the epicenter, I would imagine, in your mind.
Of course. Yeah, and we're seeing, and it's little things and big things. It's a transportation bill which will keep this recovery going. I mean, the turnaround started in many ways with the auto rescue. We know that to get out of recession, you need to grow manufacturing. That's always done that in our country. The auto rescue made a huge difference in my state, but across the country, we've seen manufacturing job growth for most of the last, for 12 years, we lost manufacturing jobs from 97 to 09. The last 2 years, almost every month, we've seen manufacturing job growth. And so we passed a transportation bill. We also, in that bill, we had an amendment I offered on Buy America. So if you're using steel
in a bridge paid for by U.S. taxpayers, it better be American steel. Every other country does that almost except for us. And it's time we do that. It's time we stand up for our workers and our companies.
Franklin Roosevelt passed that law in 1935, and it was Reagan who started looking for, let's find some loopholes in this thing.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's just gone nuts ever since then. So I so salute your efforts to revalidate that.
It's amazing how many senators, mostly Republicans, but in both parties, who think that Buy America might not be a good thing, that it might start a trade war. Well, there's been a trade war in this world, and China's winning it. And China, in many ways, as most countries, they practice trade according to their national interest, and we practice trade according to some out of print 20-year-old college economics textbook.
Yeah, that was written by Milton Friedman.
it's written by Milton Friedman.
By a crackpot.
And all his acolytes. Good point. Well said.
Yeah, it really is. I mean, it's Chicago School of Economics. We've had this experiment for 30 years. It's called Reaganomics, and it's destroyed our country.
Yeah, yeah. I was talking to two guys today that came to see me who want to be nominated, who have been nominated to serve in the Fed, one Federal Reserve, one Republican, one Democrat, to be what are called governors in the Federal Reserve. And my committee, the Banking Committee, confirms them or not, and at least has the hearings. And we were talking about 30 years ago, 26-27% of our GDP was manufacturing, and about 10% was financial services. Today, it's almost the reverse.
Yep.
About 25% financial services, not quite, and about 10% making things. And no wonder the middle class has been hurt in this country. I mean, it's the ticket to the middle class for many Americans, high school graduates, community college graduates often, are people that make things, and there just aren't enough of those jobs to make things. And banking can help us move forward, but when so much of it is Wall Street and derivatives, it creates wealth for a very small number of people passing money back and forth, but leaves out a broad middle class. And that's what's distressing about the policy. You know, the government picked winners and losers 30 years ago. They picked financial services, and it's wrong, and we've got to turn that around.
Nancy Pelosi, when she was Speaker of the House, succeeded in getting legislation through the House of Representatives and handed it off to the Senate that would have ended tax deductions for companies that were tearing apart factories. We've lost 60,000 factories since George Bush became president, that would have ended the tax deduction, government subsidy for companies that are tearing apart factories in America and rebuilding them overseas, and would have given a tax subsidy or a benefit to companies who tear down their factories overseas and bring them back here. The Republicans in the United States Senate filibustered that and refused to allow it to become law. How is it that the average American doesn't know that? And how can we get that to the front of the discussion again?
I think the average American doesn't know it because Democrats don't want to talk about it enough. I mean, Democrats are always afraid. I mean, Bernie Sanders isn't on your show, and Sheldon Whitehouse, and a lot of my colleagues aren't afraid, but a number of them in both parties are really afraid of standing up, thinking it's jingoism or thinking it's going to start a trade war or whatever. But when a company in Springfield, Ohio, or Mansfield, Ohio, or Youngstown can shut down, move its production to China, deduct the cost of the move, then sell products back, made in China, sell them back to our market. It's bad for the environment, first of all, in a lot of rate levels. And second, it makes no economic sense in the big picture, but we have built a political system where lobbyists have had such influence to give incentives to do that rather than giving incentives to stay here and produce here. And it really has been a 30-year betrayal of the middle class and of working families and poor families that want a chance to get ahead. And that's what's so disturbing about what our government's done in the last quarter century.
Yeah. And not only that, they get a tax deduction for the cost of transportation to bring those goods back to the United States after they're manufactured.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
It is. And plus, if they're made over offshore, they can keep their profits offshore. They can create an offshore division, stick the money in the Cayman Islands, never pay U.S. taxes on it. So there's, what, $1 trillion floating around out there?
It's going to be interesting. Exactly. It's going to be interesting to watch Mitt Romney try to build a public case on why it's in America's national interest that a candidate for president can move his money offshore and for any reason that makes sense for the American public. I mean, you're exactly right. Every few years, companies come to Congress and say, if we repatriate our profits, if we bring our profits back from overseas, we won't do that unless you give us a big tax cut on these profits. So if Congress does it, which there is some pressure to do, then it just gives them incentives to again, manufacture overseas, build up the reserves, come to Congress a decade from now or 5 years from now and say, let's do it again.
You're absolutely
and
right.
That's what they did this several years ago, and everybody said, well, this will get them back to invest here, and they didn't invest here. They did stock buybacks. They gave it to executives. They didn't invest in communities.
Senator Brown, we're out of time, but Senator Sherrod Brown, brown.senate.gov, and we'll be back with Bunch and Bernie tomorrow. Thanks a lot, Senator.
Thanks very much.